Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Corporation Securities and Antitrust and Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, April 19, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing antitrust enforcement by state attorney generals. My name is Laura Flint, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Vic Doman, Senior Antitrust Counsel at the Tennessee Attorney General's Office, Jennifer Thompson, Senior Deputy Attorney General at the Pennsylvania Attorney General's Office, Jeffrey Oliver, Senior Associate at Baker Botts, Ian Connor, Deputy Director of the Bureau of Competition at the FTC, and our moderator, Adam Beagle, co-chair of the antitrust team and partner at Alston & Byrd. After an introduction from Adam and hearing from our speakers, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for sitting with us, Adam. The floor is yours.
Great. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Laura said, this is Adam Beagle at Alston & Byrd in Washington, D.C., and I'd like to welcome you to our program. Today, we're going to be talking about a very interesting and important topic that is not always well understood by in-house counsel or non-antitrust lawyers, or frankly, even sometimes antitrust lawyers. It is about the overlapping antitrust enforcement jurisdiction between the federal government and state attorneys general, which can pose very important issues both for state and federal agencies as well as the industries that come under their jurisdiction, which are essentially all industries in the United States economy. As many people know, in addition to the federal antitrust laws that govern everything from mergers to ordinary business conduct, many states have their own antitrust laws, and states also have jurisdiction and standing to bring claims under the federal antitrust laws. So you have overlapping and complementary people watching the antitrust laws both on a state and federal level. And in recent months and years, there has certainly been a very large level of activity coming from state attorneys general. So for our discussion today, we're going to talk about trends that are developing and coming down the pike in antitrust enforcement coming out of the state capitals as a place that you cannot ignore if you're a business counselor or work at a corporation or practice antitrust law. And we have a distinguished panel today that is going to be discussing this topic with us. Our host, Laura, mentioned, we have Vic Doman with the Tennessee Attorney General's Office, and Vic has the distinction of not only being the lead antitrust and consumer protection lawyer for his state attorney general in Nashville, but he is also chair of the National Association of Attorneys General Task Force on antitrust and has served in that capacity since 2015, and so, as we'll discuss more, is privy to the issues of states that coordinate with each other to enforce federal and state antitrust laws. We also have Jennifer Thompson, Senior Deputy Attorney General in the Antitrust Section of the Pennsylvania Office of Attorney General in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, who has practiced antitrust law throughout her career and has been very active in antitrust enforcement actions. And also in her capacity in the Attorney General's office, she has served on various state boards in the state of Pennsylvania, including the State Board of Cosmetology and the Real Estate Commission, which become relevant to our discussion today about the operations of state attorneys general. We also have Jeff Oliver, an associate in Baker Botts' Antitrust Competition Practice Group here in Washington. And a more detailed bio is Jeff is formerly a staff attorney at the Federal Trade Commission in Washington, and also has participated as defense counsel in merger challenges brought by state attorneys general in litigation. And last but not least, we have Ian Connor, who, as noted, is current deputy director of the Bureau of Competition at the Federal Trade Commission here in Washington, and he was previously a partner in the antitrust group at Kirkland & Ellis in Washington and also served as a trial attorney with the United States Department of Justice Antitrust Division. So a diverse array of speakers who have seen this from various perspectives. So to begin our discussion, I wanted to ask Vic and Jennifer, if she wishes to add anything, to tell us about where states are coming from as they enforce antitrust laws. What's the lay of the land about how they consider cases, bring cases, investigate matters, and coordinate with each other so that our listeners can really have an understanding of how states begin to fit into this mosaic of enforcing antitrust laws. Vic, would you please explain that for our audience a little bit?
Sure. No, I'd be happy to. And thank you, Adam, and Federalist Society for giving us an opportunity to speak today. And I think it's a topic that I think many folks have been asking about, where the state AGs are in antitrust and competition enforcement and what we do. So, yeah, as Adam indicated, I think it might be good to start with a little history, if you want to call it that, about how we got our authority and what we use when we start enforcing the antitrust laws. So, believe it or not, everyone's familiar with the Sherman Act that was passed in 1890 as a federal antitrust statute. But what many folks may not know is that the states started battling this perhaps even earlier. And I think at the time that the Sherman Act was passed, about 26 states already had an antitrust statute in place. And certainly a lot of it was in response to Standard Oil and the other trusts that existed at the time. But since that time, in addition to just the state laws that have been passed, federal law has recognized the state AGs and their authority. So without getting into too much detail about where that comes from, I just wanted to mention that, under federal law, the AGs have authority to sue as parens patriae for our citizens under the Sherman Act. And that's specifically been granted in the Hart-Scott-Rodino Antitrust Improvement Act. Second, under Section 4 of the Clayton Act, the states have authority to sue for damages on behalf of direct purchasers. So, for example, if the state is a purchaser of things, we'll sue under Section 4 of the Clayton Act as well. And then finally, under Section 17 of the Clayton Act, the states also have been granted specific authority to sue for injunctive relief. And in particular, you may want to think about the cases where the states get involved with blocking a merger, for example, where we're trying to stop something and we join the federal government. So in addition to those federal laws, of course, nearly every state in the country does have a state antitrust act. And there are one or two that don't, but in those cases, most of them use their Consumer Protection Act to work through things. So, as we talk today too, I do want to give the disclaimer that was mentioned at the top of the call, in that the opinions I'm going to express today are really just my own. I'm not speaking on behalf of my Attorney General's office or of the National Association of AGs, but I always enjoy the opportunity to talk about the activities of the state AGs. And that comes really in my role as the Antitrust Task Force Chair. What's interesting to note is that in 1983, NAG, as they're affectionately called, was working under perhaps a perception that there was a lessening of antitrust enforcement by our federal partners. And so the AGs decided to form what's now known as the Multi-State Antitrust Task Force. And the whole point of that task force was to give the opportunity for the state AGs to kind of share our ideas and pool our resources when it comes to antitrust enforcement. So since that time, we've all worked together, and it gives us really the chance to just kind of share our ideas and come up with ideas of how to enforce the antitrust laws, both on the state level and the federal level, as a group, as a multi-state. And what becomes of that are sometimes multi-state actions that I think we're going to talk about in a little while. But the important thing to think about, which I think is important to this group as well, is that, the AGs are their own individual sovereigns, right? Sometimes AGs want to work as a group. Sometimes they want to blaze their own trail and work differently. And I think it's important to note that given the 50 state AGs, as well as some territories, and of course the District of Columbia, there are a number of different ideas and opinions, and they certainly can go off in different directions. And in fact, this November, there are going to be votes in 30 different states and the District of Columbia and two territories who will choose new AGs or will choose an attorney general. And of those 30 jurisdictions, 10 of those have open seats, meaning we will have 10 new AGs in place after the November elections. Other than that, I think I'll open it up and let Jennifer add a few things, but I did want to make just one additional point. The AGs are always focused on local issues, in particular healthcare issues, for antitrust enforcement, but I think we'll get into that a little more in just a few minutes. So, Jennifer, if you have anything to add, feel free.
Vic, that was actually a fantastic summary, so I just have a couple of things. First, I need to echo Vic's disclaimer that the views that I am expressing here today are my views and not necessarily the views of our Attorney General. I wanted to follow up on something that Vic said. I don't think that we can overstate the importance of the NAG Antitrust Task Force, certainly in coordination among the states and coordination with the federal agencies. Vic and his predecessors have done an amazing job putting together protocols, getting this organized, facilitating cooperation. And frankly, that makes it far easier on the targets that we're investigating. The reason for a lot of that is to ensure that you're not getting 51 or 52 different requests. And that's very important to us. At the end of the day, our primary goal is protecting consumers, and we want to do that in the most sensible way possible. Pennsylvania is, unfortunately, one of the few states that doesn't have a purely antitrust statute, but we do enforce the antitrust laws through a few methods. One is we do enforce the federal antitrust laws. Next, we actually have a body of common law of antitrust in Pennsylvania that, as Vic noted, a lot of these laws do predate the Sherman Act, and this one certainly does. Pennsylvania has been around a long time. And then we also do use our consumer protection laws. So even without a strict antitrust statute, that certainly has not hindered our ability to enforce the law when we believe it's appropriate.
So, Jennifer, what I guess does lead a state to you know, open an investigation and bring a case? Is it a you know, a strong local connection, or is it something where the federal government may have chosen not to you know, take any action, or are there any other common denominators that sort of motivate a state AG's office to be, you know, exercising that jurisdiction you talked about?
Definitely the first one. We look at the impact on consumers as any case is particular to Pennsylvania. And some of the cases we will be in from day one. Other cases we may learn from the federal agencies that an impact in Pennsylvania has been identified. Sometimes the federal agencies will reach out to us if there is a case that involves something that is under the jurisdiction of the state, such as, you know, the state insurance laws. We can certainly help facilitate communications. We can look at things more on the ground. One thing that we certainly bring is we will do a lot of the witness interviews that are within our state. But really, it is the local effect. If there is a national merger that does not have a particularized impact in Pennsylvania, Sometimes we will look at those, but often we say, well, this is actually more appropriately handled by the federal agencies because this does not impact us any differently than it's going to impact Tennessee or any other state. But if, you know, a hospital merger is a great example of an on-the-ground impact in Pennsylvania, I think citing two of the insurance cases that were brought by the Department of Justice and a group of states last year, or actually the year before at this point, we participated in the Aetna Humana litigation, and that was because there were 10 counties in Pennsylvania where there was going to be illegal concentration. So we became part of that case. That's a great example of something we look at. We've participated in the airline mergers because, you know, we have an American Airlines hub in Philadelphia. We used to have a U.S. Airways hub in Pittsburgh, and that's something that is very important to our consumers.
Sure. And Ian, from your perspective at the Federal Trade Commission, you know, how do you view the role of, you know, states in terms of, you know, working with you on cases and how you work on cases, or you know, as someone who may be sort of parting ways on some matters from time to time?
And so I have to start with a similar disclaimer to Vic and to Jennifer. My views, as stated, do not necessarily represent the views of the Federal Trade Commission, any individual commissioner, or the Bureau of Competition. So with that, I will say, we try and work very closely with the state AGs, especially in situations where we do have a locally focused transaction. As Jennifer pointed out, there may be situations where the Federal Trade Commission may be better positioned to handle a multi-state or a national matter. Typically, that is done in partnership with any interested or affected states. But the states themselves often have a unique expertise and understanding of the marketplaces within their state, and so they often will be better positioned than the FTC to focus on something that is an intrastate issue, so a merger or a combination that affects a locality or conduct that is directed at a certain area that is solely within their own states. And so in that case, you may see the federal government, either the DOJ or the FTC, stepping back and allowing the states to really be the drivers there, to the degree that we can provide any assistance that they would like, we would do so. But often the state AGs really are the driving forces in those more locally focused cases. And as I think both Jennifer and Vic flagged, the AGs have consumer protection and competition often within one office or even one person, whereas at least at the FTC, it's broken out between the Bureau of Competition and then the Bureau of Consumer Protection, and the DOJ doesn't even have a real consumer protection focus to it. It is solely an antitrust agency. So those are some of the reasons that you might see a differential, but by and large, we are working together on cases that affect the states locally or multi-state.
Sure. Thank you, Ian. In recent months and years, observers of antitrust enforcement have noted that there are certainly some examples of state attorneys general acting separately from the federal antitrust enforcement agencies, the Justice Department and Federal Trade Commission. Recent examples, I think, that have grabbed attention include the Justice Department's challenge to American Express's retailer and card rules, which was only appealed by the state attorneys general, led by the Ohio Attorney General's office. A recent post-merger consummation challenge by the Washington Attorney General's office by itself, as well as a recent lawsuit by the California Attorney General's office against a health system in California. I'd like to ask members of the panel whether it's correct to perceive an increase in sort of the go-it-alone antitrust enforcement by state attorneys general, or whether there are other circumstances that would explain this add information to that discussion.
Well, Vic, Adam,
how do you see that?
Sure. No, I'm happy to start that discussion off. And at first, one thing I do want to really emphasize, and I think Ian touched on this and Jennifer did as well, is that the state AGs and the FTC and the DOJ have a very, I would consider, very close relationship. We have worked very well hand in hand for years, and I expect that to continue, and it has in many, many cases. It's just really a matter of certain circumstances that might cause one or the other to kind of run with it and take the lead. And so you mentioned American Express, where I guess originally 17 state AGs and the DOJ challenged some of American Express's restrictions on retailers from disclosing to customers perhaps the cheapest form of credit to use. And that case began in 2010, and we all investigated together. We brought the litigation together, and it was moving through the courts. On the district court level, we won. In the Second Circuit, we lost. And so it was ripe for cert to the U.S. Supreme Court. There was a transition at the federal level, but we were still all plaintiffs together. And so when the deadlines were coming to determine whether to file for cert or not, the states, in an attempt to work with the DOJ and help, decided to take the lead. And so the Ohio AG's office, with a number of other states that were original plaintiffs, decided to seek a petition for cert. And, it's always a crapshoot as to whether you're going to have cert granted or not. And lo and behold, the Supreme Court did grant cert. And so when you ask for it, you get it, and it's time for you to kind of step up to the plate. And so once a cert was granted, the DOJ and the states we're all working together again, and at oral argument, which was just a month and a half ago or so, the Solicitor General for Ohio argued for part of the time, and then the DOJ argued for the rest of the time. And so we worked together, and now we're just going to wait to see what happens in that case. So I don't know that it's I don't want to give the perception that that the states are necessarily going it alone. We do work very well with our federal counterparts and expect to do that. But as Jennifer also indicated, there are times when the states may be able to make a run at something that has a particular local impact. And you mentioned briefly the challenge in California to the Sutter Health System. A unique impact for the state of California by a service provider, especially in Northern California, where you have a very sophisticated California AG's office and antitrust section who can bring that case on their own. In Washington State, the same thing, a challenge to the Franciscan CHI parties, where once again, you have a very sophisticated AG's office who can bring that challenge and really let the FTC get on with a lot of other matters. It's really just a matter of really helping each other. And if we can make a go of it and we have the resources to do it, we will. So I don't know, Jennifer, do you have anything you might like to add to that?
I would actually. I spoke a little while ago about how in some cases when we're determining whether or not to get involved in a case or join litigation, that we'll say, well, this has the same impact in Pennsylvania that it has in multiple other states. And that is a degree of respect that we have for the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission where, you know, to summarize, you've got this. So without citing any specific examples, for any state, there may be numerous cases where the FTC and DOJ have partnered with us during the investigation phase, and then we get to the point where there may be action, and it's not uncommon for them to say, you've got this, or to turn part of an investigation over, because there have been just a wave of mergers in recent years, and just the uptick just keeps going, and sometimes it's more appropriate for an agency to move on to something else. And it's really, a lot of people read into it, well, the FTC didn't do anything, so there must not be a problem, but it's really more a matter of respect where they say, well, you can handle this now. And they're always a resource that's available during these investigations, and it's invaluable, and it's like Vic has said, it's extremely friendly, extremely cooperative. It's a great relationship, and we can't overstate that.
Great. Ian, can't help but ask your perspective on it. Some of the talking heads might have, I guess, thrown out ideas saying, well, the state, you're seeing more of the state activity because there's a lack of interest in Washington in merger enforcement. Just to put that straw man out there, I mean, how would you view, I guess, what Jennifer and Vic are talking about the relationship between the states and the federal government, just because we're seeing, you know, some solo state action in enforcement recently?
To the degree that there has been an uptick in state enforcement over the past year, I do not think it's a result of an effort to fill a gap in federal enforcement. The DOJ certainly, I think, would dispute that they're not presently litigating the AT&T Time Warner challenge vociferously. Since I arrived at the FTC in September, we have challenged 5 mergers, 2 of which have been abandoned. And we won a preliminary injunction and another merger challenge up in North Dakota, in which we did partner with the state attorney general for North Dakota. And that doesn't even include the consents that we've had over the past several months. One thing to consider is there is a natural fluctuation in mergers filings and merger challenges that is precipitated by the mergers that are proposed. So there may be an uptick in the number of mergers proposed, but if they are not strategic mergers in that they don't involve 2 companies in the same industry and so there's no competitive overlap, there would be no reason for us to challenge. Similarly, the one thing I would point out is, at least at the FTC, we have some statutory limits that affect our ability to challenge certain conduct, not the mergers, but the conduct. And so if you look at Sutter Health, that is, as Vic flagged, a very localized issue in Northern California, but I believe Sutter Health is a nonprofit, and the FTC has limitations on its ability to bring conduct cases on nonprofits. And so in that case, we would either refer it to the Justice Department, and you can see that in the Carolinas case, or we would, as Jennifer said, say to the state, you've got this. You guys, it's an interstate issue. We can't step in, but I know, especially in states like California that have very, very sophisticated attorney general's offices staffed with people who have been doing antitrust far longer than I have, and they know very well how to prosecute a case and have done so before. The last thing I would flag is something that Jennifer briefly touched on. There are resource constraints that both the federal and the state AGs have to deal with. And so it may be something where it doesn't make sense to have federal and state resources directed at fixing the exact same problem. And so you'll see the federal agencies step up, or you'll see the state AGs step up and the other groups step back from that. But overall, I would not read anything into the fact that the state AGs have decided to bring certain cases as far as trying to fill a void in federal enforcement.
Thank you. I want to make sure we brought Jeff into this discussion as well. So if we've laid the groundwork for, you know, who the players are, what their interests are, and some recent trends, you know, Jeff, when you're advising clients on mergers or business conduct and thinking about, you know, all the guidance coming out of the federal agencies in Washington, you know, how do you factor in, you know, other things coming out of all the state capitals that Vic and Jennifer were talking about to try to advise clients? Do we have a risk of, you know, disparate interpretations of the antitrust laws or anything like that, where, you know, you may be, you know, satisfying, 49 people, but there's one person that or one attorney general's office that, you know, really has an issue? Do we have to watch all those corners for clients to achieve business objectives?
Yeah, it's a great question, and thank you. I'll repeat the standard disclaimer that I'm speaking for myself today and no one else. So I would say that over the last year, definitely my counsel to clients with regard to the potential for state enforcement, whether it be a follow-on enforcement from an agency decision not to enforce anything, or if it be a standalone, I would say I've become much more conservative in that counsel, meaning that the risk has, in my opinion, has gone up. I do think there's a trend in maybe just in certain states, but maybe across the board, there's an energy there that I just don't think had been there before. And let me talk a little bit about why I think that is. I don't think you can entirely discount the interplay between federal politics and state politics right now. And so if, say, I had a client with a merger that implicated California or New York, my counsel would be very specific with regard to the risk that there would be significant or potential for significant sort of incremental enforcement in addition to whatever happens at the federal level. And I think that's just maybe a cynical calculus, but I think it can't be discounted that those particular states are led by very ambitious elected attorneys general and who have made no bones about positioning themselves as part, to some extent, of a kind of resistance to federal trends, primarily, I think, the trend toward less regulation. And I just think that's, it would be remarkable, wouldn't it, if that didn't show itself as an increase in state, at least an increase in the risk of state-level enforcement. And I think we've seen an actual increase in state-level enforcement. And I do attribute it somewhat to that dynamic. I just think it almost definitely plays a role. These offices, state's attorney general, particularly in states like New York and California, they are a kind of launching pad to higher office. I think these individuals are very competent, sincere. I'm not questioning at all that they go after issues that they see as legitimate. But I do see a window in the sense that it's easier for the time being, I think, to justify expending the resources on this type of action when you have a federal government that has made it clear that they want to deregulate in a lot of ways. I think the case for state, in that sense, I guess I would say the case for state action I mean, state enforcement, particularly in blue states, has just become easier to make for these states' attorney general. And I fully expect that Jennifer and Vic will have some pushback on that, and I welcome it. But that is my sense of things, and that's how I would counsel clients.
Yeah, Jennifer and Vic, I guess on that question, the larger one of, you know, what role does the fact that, you know, there are directly elected, except for Tennessee, political actors leading the attorney general's offices play in enforcement decisions? I mean, you mentioned all those elections. Do the elections matter on state antitrust enforcement?
Well, I'll start, I think, with some brief comments about that. And I think the thing that everyone needs to remember, and this I think goes for the federal level as well, is that although there are different AGs coming and going, the staff remains pretty constant. And so most of the people that I work with have been there. You know, Jennifer and I have been with our offices for a long time. Many of the offices that we're talking about here, although perhaps the antitrust bureau chief may change, the staff are the same. Our ideas haven't changed. And I think that typically, both Republicans and Democrats really look at the antitrust laws as being kind of party blind. I mean, they really deal specifically with competition and the importance of promoting competition. And I think that's where we set our sights. That's what we're looking for. I think every AG wants the businesses in their own state to prosper, and competition is a good thing. And that's what we want in all of our AG's offices. So, and that's understood, I think, not only through the antitrust laws, but also through the staff. So I think that if a retrospective is done about whether there's an increase or a decrease in state enforcement, I'm not sure that there are going to be these big bumps during certain administrations. And it's probably worth kind of looking at. I'm sure we could probably get a summer intern to take a look at some of those statistics to see if state enforcement has changed or increased, or whether we're just hearing about it a little bit more. But you know, when it comes to the AGs, you're right. I mean, you know, they certainly, most of them are elected. I can say here in Tennessee, thankfully, as a staff level person, I'm lucky enough to have an AG who's appointed by our Supreme Court. So that takes a lot of the politics out of it, and we're allowed to go ahead and do our job. But my fellow enforcers in other states may not be quite so lucky. And sure, AGs have a lot of issues and agendas that they may be looking into, but when it comes to the investigative phase and the recommendation phase, the people making those decisions are the same people who've made them through multiple elections and multiple administrations. So I don't know that there's really as much of a change when there's a changing of the guard in the front office as people may perceive. Jennifer, I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that.
No, I think you summarized it beautifully. Just a couple of things. From my perspective here in Pennsylvania, being a staff attorney for a very long time, very little changes. We have had, I believe, I think 4 elected AGs since I've been here, and then a couple had left early, and they had appointees that came in and served the rest of their terms. And they have been from both parties. And for me, there has been no difference between reporting to a Republican AG versus a Democratic AG. We've talked a little bit about the expertise of the antitrust bureaus at the state level, and we have to remember that a lot of the AGs who come in, their attention is divided among multiple areas of law. I mean, right now, it's probably safe to say that our AG is more concerned about the opioid epidemic than virtually anything else. They're enforcing the criminal laws. They're defending state agencies. I'm part of something called the Public Protection Division, which includes charitable trusts. It includes consumer protection. It includes tobacco enforcement. There's really a lot going on under the AG's umbrella. So they really rely on the expertise of the staff to report up and explain to them what is going on in a particular case, talk to them about whether or not action may be appropriate. And fairly consistently, they listen to the staff. It's definitely bottom-up management versus top-down management. And I personally have never been asked to do anything for a political reason. One other thing I want to say is this is a topic that is not new. Vic and I were on a panel for the ABA, I think in January of last year, just before the new presidential administration came in. And the question was, what is antitrust law going to look like under the Trump administration? And we are, you know, what, 14 months in at this point, 15 months. There have been very few changes. It's been a pleasant surprise. I mean, we're still working with the same people in other states in the same manner that we always have, and in the same situation with the federal agencies.
Let me ask Jeff about his perspective on sort of where we are today. And you mentioned that conservative advice. You know, if you were got word that one of your clients was being investigated by a state attorney general, you know, would you proceed differently based on, you know, some of the things that Vic and Jennifer were talking about the politics of it? I mean, would you be more likely to, you know, get business leaders to, you know, call on the attorney general who maybe they had a relationship with, which you might not do as early in a federal investigation with those appointed leaders? Or, you know, do you just try to resolve the concerns that are brought to you? And, you know, an enforcement agency is an enforcement agency.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think there's a blind spot for folks like me who do this full time in Washington. It can be very tough to know how to approach a state AG's office in terms of advocacy, and I think that's one area where, if this is a trend or if it's not a trend, I think there's a lot of room for improvement, I guess I would say. I think one of the difficult parts is knowing, you know, so how does the decision actually get made then? It sounds like staff, at least in the states represented on this call, are making the calls. As we've indicated, there's 48 other states. Is it the same process there? And in comparison, so a good point of comparison, of course, is how it works at the federal level. And there, you know, there's a very specific process, and parties get, you know, multiple bites at the apple with every stage of the decision. When you go with staff, you've got the months and months of the investigation, and you know you're going to get your time with them. And then it goes up to the Bureau if you're at the FTC or the equivalent level at the DOJ, and you get your time with the Bureau, and then they all wrap up their recommendations, and it goes up to the Commission or the antitrust AG, and you get your bite there. And there's an extraordinary level of due process, right? And I think that's been built in over time as a kind of recognition of how, at least on the merger side, how difficult the prognostication is, which is the whole game is trying to predict what's going to happen post-merger based on very limited information, and a recognition that even when you have just very good information, it's really, really hard to predict the future. So that's an explanation for why there's so much due process, I think, at the FTC. My experience at the state level has been that it's harder to come by that kind of due process, and it's just harder to know how to influence the decision. And so if I had a merger tomorrow that was in front of the states that are represented on the call or anywhere, I mean, my recommendation would be you kind of have to force this due process. You have to be very aggressive about getting face time with whoever the persuadable party is. If that's staff, then staff, and I'm sure that would be the initial approach on any deal. But then asking for time with the state AG, which in my experience is not always offered up. That's his name or her name is going to be the one that appears on the complaint at some point. I think They're the ultimate decision matter in or maker in any matter, and I would recommend to parties, look, it's a bit of a black box in my experience, and we're kind of going to have to just be creative, and I'm just trying to be as honest as I can. That's how I've approached the state AGs. Now I'm sure there's more experienced players than me who just know how it works. But my experience, again, is that it's not always clear, actually, how to advocate effectively before a state AG, partially because it's almost always been that they follow on and you're advocating to all of them at once, which means you're just advocating to the FTC and the states are listening in. and then they all sort of come out on the same page, at least in the past. Lately, that hasn't been the case. But let me stop there and let others respond.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is a good opportunity maybe to open up that black box. Vic and Jennifer, in your experience, either in your offices or work on the NAG task force, you know, how could someone in Jeff's position, appropriately, try to seek that due process that they'd like to have to make sure there's, appropriate consideration of all perspectives and everyone's, hearing the parties out?
Jennifer, I don't know. Do you want to go, or I'm happy to if you prefer.
Sure, I'll start. We do have a very structured level system in our office. We have the Attorney General, we have the First Deputy Attorney General, then we have three division directors. Each of the division directors has oversight of the various sections in the office. I'm actually fairly low on the totem pole. I'm not at any level in that. I'm at the very bottom. But any request that parties may have to meet with anyone in that chain of command is completely respected. Staff is always available to meet. If a request to meet with the AG is made, we do everything we can to facilitate that. It often does take longer just because of the time constraints that the attorneys general have, or at least our attorney general has. But if ultimately they're unable to make the meeting, they may designate to the first deputy. But we appreciate any information that people come in and want to provide to us. Our analysis is very fact-based. So, we've looked carefully at gathering information on the markets. We've conducted an economic analysis. We've looked at potential defenses. We've looked at whether or not, if somebody is raising a failing firm defense, we will vet that. We have all that information available. It's actually far more common for us to not bring a case than to bring litigation. So, we carefully consider everything. And we are always happy to hear from the parties. So if you were to ever have a problem here in Pennsylvania, certainly reach out to me, reach out to our section chief, and make sure that we know that you want to come in and we can make that happen. The door is always open. We don't have quite the timeline structures that the federal agencies have, but we certainly have the availability. And Dick, I'll turn it over to you now.
Right. And just to add to that a little bit, so when an investigation is begun, as I said, we'll typically partner up with whichever federal agency, and I'm talking more about national matters that have local impact. We'll partner up with either Ian at the FTC or with folks at the DOJ, and a working group will form. Now, naturally, there are 50 plus AGs, and 50 AGs aren't in every matter. But say a working group is created that includes 12 or 20 state AGs. In that working group structure, a lead state or lead states are appointed. And they are the executive committee, for lack of a better term, and they will be the point person for counsel for the parties. So, and I know Jeff knows this, but so if Jeff is looking to get it to perhaps take the temperature of the state as a whole, he can reach out to the one of the states in the executive committee to get a sense of where they are, what's going on. And I think as the investigation goes on, they become very familiar with the state AGs and really who's speaking on behalf of them. Now, if we're getting closer to litigation, of course, I think at that point, counsel for the parties recognize where some of the issues may lie, because oftentimes they're very similar between the states and the DOJ or FTC. And if that's a point where counsel for the parties wants to talk, as Jennifer said, we are always open to it. My office, and I think all the AG's offices, always have an open door with that. And so I think it's pretty common. I know it is in some of the investigations we've conducted for counsel for the parties to not only meet with the heads of the federal agencies, but also to request a meeting with our front office. And as I said, we're always open to that. Our AGs, in any of the cases that I would say that where you've seen state participation, at least by my state, in the last few years, you can bet that there probably was a meeting that took place with counsel for the parties and or representatives from the parties with our front office. Typically, we'll participate in that and we'll be there. But not always. Sometimes there are meetings I don't know about, right? As a staff level person, but that door is open, in our state. And I think it is in just about every state, that participates in the working group for a particular matter.
Sure. I want to squeeze in one more question before we check to see if there were any questions from the audience. From your perspective, Ian, if people are working with the AG's office outside the Beltway, does that play any role in the FTC decision making? You know, if Jeff is successfully convinced an AG's office that something is not worth pursuing or something like that, could an AG be an advocate to provide input to the federal antitrust enforcement agencies to say, this is a local concern. The federal government shouldn't they should step away from an antitrust perspective and leave it alone. Do you ever see that?
So, and as we've said multiple times on this call, and we work closely with the state AGs and are in fairly constant communication with them where they're involved in one of our matters. I can't think of an instance where an AG has resolved something through some sort of consent and then said, FTC or DOJ, now that we've resolved it, this is a local issue and you need to step out of it. There are situations in which the state legislature has enacted certain laws that grant antitrust immunity. So the COPA and certificate of need laws in the healthcare space would be examples of that, where we, for instance, had a challenge to a hospital merger in West Virginia, I think probably 18 months ago, and the state of West Virginia legislature decided that they would pass a state law that permitted that merger to go through, and at that point we stepped back. So there are situations in that under that scenario, but I can't remember an AG actually coming up to and saying you need to exit this investigation because I've got it handled.
I do want to come back to that COPA issue, but I did want to ask Laura whether we have any questions on the line, because we're happy to entertain them.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. It looks like we have one audience questioner. Shall we go to them?
Okay, certainly.
Hi, a friend of mine had been chief patent counsel for Texaco, and he said that every time the various attorney generals were elected, they would bring an antitrust suit against the oil companies, and that would go on for a while until that just would sort of peter out, but it was a great way to grandstand when they first got elected. Does that still go on?
I mean, I guess I'll take that first. I wouldn't say that's the case at all. I have not seen, certainly there are, for lack of a better term, usual suspects, right? There are state AG's offices which have always been strong antitrust enforcers, and so you'll see their name again and again. And so I don't know that it's necessarily the election of a new AG that makes a difference so much as the fact that certain states have a tendency to be, stronger competition advocates and stronger competition enforcers. And so I don't know that I've seen any uptick or change necessarily when a new AG is elected so much as the office continues what it has always done, and so the reputation kind of remains the same, for lack of a better term.
This is Jeff. I could jump in here. I have, I think, maybe a unique perspective in that may be that it's possible that that's the reason I'm on this call. Let me explain what happened with me and my client, and then, we can theorize whether it fits into your conception of how it works. So we represented Valero in their proposed acquisition of two oil and gas terminals from Plains in California, Plains All American. And the FTC took its time with the investigation. Staff made a recommendation to block the deal. The commission disagreed and took no action. And let the clock expire, meaning that the deal would have been free to close. California, who had a fairly new attorney AG at that point. Attorney General at that point, with I think a strong platform of consistent with Democratic platform, which I think increasingly includes an antitrust plank to it. Staff, again, it's hard to tell who, decided that they were going to try and block the deal even after the FTC had passed on it. They sued for a TRO. The judge denied that, temporary restraining order. California went for then a preliminary injunction. The judge denied that, but not without giving some substantive comfort to California in his order denying the PI. When California made it clear that they were likely to go for a permanent injunction, the parties ended up abandoning the deal because it was a small deal and it had gone on for well over a year, and parties just needed to move on. But I don't know, you know, it's so hard to tell what the motivations were. I don't doubt the sincerity, but I don't think, I just think you have to take it in context of current events, both at the federal level and at the state level. It's hard to go wrong challenging oil and gas deals in California. So there's always that risk there, and that was built into the analysis from the outset. But for what it's worth, I offer that story as perhaps support for the theory you're proposing here.
Jeff, this is Jennifer, and I think I know virtually nothing about this, so listening to you explain it was very interesting, but the one thing that jumped out at me in what you said was that the FTC staff did believe that there was enough there to recommend challenging the transaction, and even if the commission ultimately voted not to go forward with that, it still indicates to me, based on my experience with FTC staff, which is pretty expansive, that there was probably enough there that, you know, it makes sense that California staff would believe that they could, you know, that they should challenge the transaction. So that's just my takeaway, knowing nothing. That was just the one thing that jumped at me based on what you said versus, you know, assuming it was political. It does really sound like that there was a very sound legal basis.
Let me, and it's quite possible. And I should clarify a couple things. One, I didn't see the staff's recommendation memo, of course. I can only assume that since we were at the front office we're talking to the commissioners, that there was a recommendation to block. I'd offer maybe just an example and maybe this helps explain why I tend to believe that ideology may have played some role here. And that is, about 6 years ago, in 2012, 2013, there was another deal in California. Tesoro bought a refinery from BP. Now, without getting too far into the weeds, there you had an actual horizontal overlap, meaning two refineries in Southern California were combining. In the Valero Plains deal, the issue was vertical. I don't want to dwell on that, but that's only to say that it was a significant issue in this prior BP Tesoro deal. Similar fact pattern, FTC passed on the deal. Staff, I was at the FTC at the time, staff was motivated to bring a suit. The commission did not. California was disappointed, but did not try to block the deal. They got some very basic behavioral remedies, something about not laying off people and not shutting down any plants and stuff like that, that I'm sure the parties were more than happy to sign on to. And so it's difficult for me to entirely dismiss the context in which each of those events occurred. At the time, Kamala Harris was the the AG in California. Barack Obama was the president. I think it would have been difficult, frankly, and I fully recognize this is a bit cynical, but I think this plays into it. I think it would have been difficult to muster the political will at the state level to do something that a very enforcement-minded administration had not done. That's just a harder sell. And I don't know, I mean, Javier Becerra, I totally respect him. I think he makes, I think, I'm sure he's pursuing what he thinks is right. I don't doubt his sincerity at all. But this dynamic of extreme disagreement, let's say, between the federal and state authorities, I just have a hard time dismissing the theory that that plays a role in some of these decisions. I do.
I wanted to make sure we got at least one more question in, and we can also check if there are other questions from the audience. I did want to just tee this up as at least a wrap up with the time we have remaining for the panelists. Ian made a good comment before about, you know, the changing role of antitrust at the state level, how you were seeing many state actors, legislatures. And administrative agencies become active in doing things that put the AGs in sort of a different role than they may have been in the past in trying to utilize, you know, state action that could potentially immunize certain conduct within a state from the federal antitrust laws. We're seeing states, you know, maybe working with their constituent entities and agencies on those kinds of issues that might insulate them from federal antitrust law. And we're also seeing, as people familiar with the North Carolina Dental Supreme Court case, we're seeing states more as defendants based on allegations that appointed boards that have a majority of competitors on them, whether it's dental boards or, you know, maybe Jennifer, I don't know, maybe your cosmetology board, perhaps, are liable for antitrust issues under federal antitrust law. So you may be a defendant also trying to defend the actions of a state board. With that as another thing that's in the mix besides the political issues and enforcement priority issues we were talking about, I just wanted to open it up for our panelists to say, you know, what they see coming down the pike and whether, you know, there's a potential for, you know, this overlapping system to become, you know, more efficient, or whether there are even any legislative proposals that would alter the balance of enforcement, jurisdiction that they're aware of between states and the federal government, or is this sort of the system we've created and people should need to live within it? So I'll sort of open that up about predictions for the future or, you know, potential for changes to our panelists.
Well, let me just, I'll start. I know we only have a minute or two, but let me just say, I mean, I think that the point you're making about state action is a good one. And I know we could go around and around with Ian on that one for another couple of hours, but I think that just goes to the federal system we have in place, right? I mean, the states have been granted certain rights as individual sovereigns. And so there are times when they'll exercise those rights. And I think that's important to the federal system that we have. And so there may be cases where a state government determines that competition may have to be affected a little bit for the better good of its citizens. And I think that we all enjoy that. So sometimes, you know, we don't agree with what's going on with folks in D.C. But second, when you ask me to kind of look ahead, I think that one thing that the listeners probably want to keep in mind is that the local interest is always important. I think that's no more important than as exemplified in healthcare. And Pennsylvania, and Jennifer can talk to this, is, you know, they are an expert in healthcare, antitrust and competition enforcement. But healthcare is a priority for all our AGs. And so many of our enforcement actions deal specifically with that, whether that's in pharmaceuticals or in healthcare mergers. But that's the key. That's the key. I mean, healthcare always has a local impact, and so we're always looking for that. And that's an area that that I think everyone should focus on. But that's it for me.
Yes, and just to support what Vic has said, healthcare is supremely important here in Pennsylvania. We live in these markets. We see the impact on our consumers, on increases in prices. We see how hard it is for people as these prices go up, as access decreases. And that is completely a priority for us to evaluate anything that affects that, any mergers, any conduct, that type of thing. And I know this is going to be very brief, but straying into this is certainly my personal opinion and not the opinion of the office or the Pennsylvania Department of State here, but regarding professional licensing, I kind of have a unique perspective because by statute, representatives from the AG's office sit on most of our licensing boards, which come under the umbrella of the Pennsylvania Department of State's Bureau of Professional and Occupational Licensing. They are supervised. They have a very strict regime in place that goes back to an old state law case where the likelihood of us seeing something like what happened in North Carolina is pretty small. There's a couple of areas where maybe something could squeak through, but there is truly, in many ways, active supervision here. So for me personally, being an antitrust enforcer, I'm troubled by a movement to pass statutes that create immunity versus passing laws that create active supervision. And that's, like I said, completely my personal opinion, but that's sort of how I balance the professional licensing versus the antitrust laws.
Ian, I'm sure you have a thought on that as we try to conclude.
I do, and I will be very brief. So, and obviously, the Federal Trade Commission has been very proactive in the last year or so on state licensing regulations that it believes are anti-competitive. And we have a number of comments that have been filed, as you can find on our website. I would suggest to everyone looking at the decision that came down from the commission last week in the Louisiana Real Estate Board case, because that is exactly the type of situation that Jennifer was just describing, where the court or the commission found that the efforts of the state there did not qualify as active supervision, and that case remains in litigation. So I would direct people to read the publicly available decision on that.
Jeff, I'll offer you a last word if you have one.
Oh, thanks. I don't have anything more substantive to add. I did want to just expand my disclaimer now that I've talked so much about my clients. Anything I said on this call, it was not intended for subsequent attribution. If there are reporters on the call and you want to talk to me about it, please give me a call and we can talk about it. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, everyone. As we've reached the top of the hour, I'd like to thank all of our panelists and audience members for participating today. And on behalf of the Corporation Securities and Antitrust Practice Group of the Federalist Society, I'd like to thank you all for joining and participating in this discussion. And Laura, I'll turn it over for you if there are any concluding remarks.
Great. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for later today at 2 p.m., and that call will be a criminal justice reform discussion. Please tune in. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone forum calls and to consult the full schedule on the Federalist Society's website. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.